Legal Counsel to order. Good morning. The May 28th meeting of the Customer Service Operations and Safety Committee. Agenda has been previously distributed. Are there any changes or corrections, additions or deletions from the agenda? If not, I'll ask unanimous consent for the agenda to be accepted as presented. Hearing no objection, the agenda is accepted. We have also before us the minutes of the April 23rd meeting, which have been previously distributed. Are there any changes or corrections to the minutes of the April 23rd meeting? Hearing none, I'll ask unanimous consent that the minutes be accepted as presented. Without objection, the minutes are accepted. And that brings us to item three, operational performance. Mr. Francis, good morning.
Good morning, Mrs. Zimmerman, members of the committee. Next slide. What you see in front of you is a snapshot of our major operational performance indicators. And you'll see some of these numbers as we go through with the presentation, but I wanted to at least give you a snapshot picture of what we look like. And this is the performance for the month of March, but it also ties back into FY08. If I can just take you through rail on-time performance, you see in FY08, we finished the year at a 91%. But our goal and target for this year is 95%, and then it shows you the year-to-date, which in this example, the year-to-date was 94%. So we use this as a snapshot to help us take a closer look at each one of the major modes and operations. As you can see, bus, vertical transportation, the metro access are all on this page. Next slide.
Actually, can you go back to a second?
Yes, sir.
Now, on second thought, go ahead and finish your presentation, Lastly.
The next slide shows you the Metro bus on-time performance. Now, we looked at this a couple of ways. Before, I've been showing you the on-time performance on a monthly basis. We look at it on a daily basis, but I thought it'd be good to give you a snapshot or a picture on how we're looking at this and how we're managing each one of the time segments. As you can see, we're measuring this or monitoring this in different segments, early AMs, both AM and PM peak, to midday service, early night and late night. You know, there's over 180 lines, about 335 routes out here. So one of the things that is good is that we have a starting point to gather a lot of data, which we have. The sheets that the bus operation personnel look at, as well as Mr. Victoria and myself, are a lot more in depth and detail. And it gives us the opportunity to take a look at this and really go after some of these time points. I know there's been discussion with the committee about our parameters, the 2 minutes early and 7 minutes late, but you can see on the early AMs we're about 85%. And we'll focus on some of that so we can do better than 85% at that particular time. And what's good about it is that we're able to break this down. We're able to look or monitor over the 500 buses that are out at that time.
Sorry, what time is that now?
From 4 a.m. to 6 a.m. Right now, we have it broken down into different time slots. So
right.
We have over 500 buses out on the street around between those hours. And we're able to monitor those buses to see if they're on time.
This is what would be to the left of the diagram that we were sent. And
exactly.
So it's outside the rush window, basically, and you have higher performance rates.
Yes.
And better data on it.
I'm sorry,
Mr. So you're saying you're able to monitor it.
Yes, because that starts our pullout. It starts our pullouts about 4 a.m., so we're able to monitor that. So we're taking a look at it. We're breaking it down because this is a big puzzle. So we broke it down into pieces to take a look at it. And now we're going to look at managing the early AMs and see we're at 85%. We think we can get to 90% and so forth. And then we'll do the same for the peak periods, and we'll do the same for late nights. But this gives us pretty much a view on how the system looks at these time intervals. From a customer service focus.
I have a clarification question. I'm sorry. Mr. Francis, you know, obviously this is better data than we've seen before, but it really raises the question of why would it go down during the day? Why would the efficiency go down? Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't it stay the same? And then, you know, we still haven't met our targets. It doesn't seem like we've actually dropped this month from our previous month. And I'm just kind of curious why you think that is. What's the reasons for the lower
target, meeting our targets, and then secondly, you know, what reasons could be looking at to maybe improve it.
Okay. Why it goes down lower during the course of the day?
Yeah.
Well, Bob's my observation first is early a.m. is from 4 a.m. to 6 a.m., and the traffic patterns at that time are a lot different.
Well, I'm not really worried about that time as much, but even look at the morning peak versus the evening peak. That's quite a big drop.
But I'm still looking at the traffic patterns that come in the morning,
yeah.
Because I guess an example I use is when we're going to special events or some outing, we use different times to get there, and the traffic patterns are different. As you go into the course of the day, you take the p.m. peak, you see our performance is down to 69%. Usually what happens then, those hours are from 3 to 7. So what happens, though, in those hours is most people get off work at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock. They're coming out more as a group, so to speak, rather than staggering as in the morning time.
You're saying because we get more people in the evening peak hour, our on-time performance goes down? Is that what you're saying?
Same, because you have more traffic probably out during the course of the later course of the day, especially between that window.
Is that consistent with the traffic studies by the city and Arlington County?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was my thought. My first thought was, well, correlate this with traffic data. You know, I don't know, Texas Transportation Institute, anybody who's studying this stuff. And if you can show that, in fact, the levels of congestion are higher in the PM peak than the AM peak consistently, then you've got an explanation that's plausible and it's out of your control. On the other hand, I haven't seen anything that says that. That may be the case. I don't know. And it seems to run counter, at least, to one aspect of the data here. There's one sort of, I don't say anomaly, but the AM peak is a three-hour period. The PM peak you're calling a four-hour period, which makes me a little uncomfortable anyway, you know, just in terms of the way we're measuring things. But if anything, that should spread things out more. So, in other words, if what you're saying is true, Mr. Francis, your hypothesis is that people are more staggered in the morning than they are in the evening. And I say intuitively, I would think it's the other way around. But maybe you're right. But if that's true, if they're more concentrated in the evening, then the peak of the peak would be the most significant point. And the shoulders around the peak would decline more. In other words, you would be really bad for 1 hour there, but you would be better in the hours around it. You follow what I'm saying? And if you pick a wider period of time, there should be more effect of that, which I would think would make the evening rush look better, not worse. So I don't know that, you know, I mean, that's something to look at in the data, but it just seems like we don't really have an explanation here.
We will look into the traffic patterns, but one of the issues that Mr. Francis mentioned, from 3 to 7 p.m., you have the additional traffic of people going to special events, sports events, going out, coming home, and then going out. Some people use public transit to commute to work.
And that's plausible. And again, if that's right, then as Mr. Giancola was suggesting, it presumably shows up in generalized traffic data.
Right.
And that might actually be the case. But I think we need to look at that and show that so people have some context for this. So it's not just that we do lousy in the evening. You know, if in fact, the main, this is why I asked, you know, the last couple of times, that we really start looking at what are the factors in driving the performance of the bus service. A large portion of it is not within our control, but we need to identify what that portion is. So, you know, if it turns out that, in fact, it's just harder to operate in the environment between 3 and 7 and 6 to 9, well, that's good to know, and then we look at the things we can control. But I'm also struck by the fact that, you know, now that you've widened the field here a bit, that 4 to 6 is, of course, the best time we have. But why is 11 to 4 a.m. not higher? Because you would think that would be kind of like operating, you know, on the other end of it, right? So I think that's the other part we've got to look at. Why do we have such a drop across here with only slight improvement in the evening? And why is 4 to 6 so different from 11 to 4?
That's exactly what I'm aiming at. And again, as you said, if it is the traffic patterns generally, fine. But the other question is, you know, you would think that the late night would be back up to the 85%.
Yeah.
I was looking at that and wondering, late night is a different service level. And the question is, and I want to go back to 7, because it would be good to rather have an early and a late peak. I don't think we're getting a good measure or reflection of I do agree that there's probably a longer concentrated in the PM because of exactly what you just described happening in the morning. There are about, I see at least three peaks in the morning. And so when you think of the concentration of that, when do all those folks come at one concentrated point cause greater stress? But data, by making it so long, doesn't give you a good measure. And on the late night, I wonder if you've got a 15-minute headway or a 12-minute headway, and you're waiting. That's a big difference.
Oh, yeah.
8 minutes or 6 minutes or 5 minutes. Are we less efficient? Does it feel less efficient? It should be on time.
Right. I can't stress enough that identifying the portion of this that is related to the limitations of the road network and the traffic conditions is vitally important, not simply to, you know, cover you to the fact that you're not responsible for most of this delay. I'm sure that's the case. But because there are things that can be done about it, and we need to be pushing to get them done, and they're done outside this building. So we need to find out the portion that you can fix and make sure you fix it. But all the stuff you can't fix, we all need to go and get worked on in other places. And that's a vital tool in our advocacy and our ability to explain why we should be given certain opportunities to improve the road network for transit purposes, whether that's dedication of lanes, queue jumpers, signal prioritization. Those things could all make this system function much more like the rail system, but we have to get it from other places. Okay, sorry to...
That's okay. And Mr. Zimmerman, I can just add, you know, the same discussions that we're having here, the same discussions that we have. I mean, these percentages that you look at are our starting points. As I mentioned earlier, we collect a lot of data. We're doing a lot of analysis, and we'll take a look at why we're 72% late night and why it's 85% in the early AMs. But it gives us something. It gives us a parameter to take a look at, and that's where the supervisors, the bus dispatchers will be also, our fleet management plan will take a look at all of that. Next slide is a Metro bus mean distance between failure. As you can see, for the month of March, we looked at this and kind of broke it down for you in a pie shape, so you can kind of take a look at the hybrid CNGs and the clean diesel. But I also wanted to point out that, you know, we talk a lot about the months, and I just wanted to point out that the average year-to-date on all three of the fleets, or four of the fleets, are in pretty good mean distance mileage. You know, you see the 20,000 for the CNG and 10,000 for the hybrids, 17,000 for the clean diesels, and the other fleets are a little bit about 5,600, but if you look at that from probably July of 07 to August of 08, it was down, and now we're starting to come back up with the other fleets as well.
I'm sorry, so the number you're looking at, you're trying to separate what's been happening in recent months from the trend across the year?
Yeah, before we gave you a snapshot monthly and just wanted to kind of have you take a look at it for the month of March, and then also look at the total miles. So the month and year-to-date average.
What strikes me, and I noticed that the table that was on page 7 did not include the line that says all other fleets. Now, all other fleets, I don't know how many vehicles are in it, but I'm guessing that those are basically the older diesel buses.
The older fleet. Yes.
I mean, those are all revenue vehicles. Those aren't non-revenue vehicles, right?
Revenue vehicles.
Right. So it is basically all other fleets means all the older diesel buses. Yeah. And they're poor performers, and they bring down the average. Although I was struck by the fact that the fleet average, where is it now, was 6,300. Is that right? If you look on back on page 7, that's the number, I believe. Overall mean distance between failures is 6,300. And it seems hard for me to figure out how that average could be that low, given the components of the other ones. Well, so here's the thing. The best performer of the bunch continues to be the CNG.
Continues to be, yes.
At almost 17,000, far better than anything else we have. They are our most reliable buses.
Yes.
Second most reliable are our new diesel buses, which are euphemistically called clean diesel. They're quite reliable, too, about, you know, 3,500 miles behind. Then there's a huge drop. The worst performers are the hybrids at less than 6,000 miles. These are buses that cost on average, what, 40 to 60% more to buy than any of the other buses?
Than the clean diesels, yes.
Or even the CNGs. I mean,
they're more expensive than the CNGs.
Much more expensive. And we're about to buy more of them, yes?
Well, two things. As a result of this discussion, I've asked the bus maintenance department to do an analysis and give me a recommendation on future purchases of vehicles. That should be completed, and we will bring back a report to you next month. I think that it should be a mix, in my judgment. We need hybrids at some facilities because you cannot do CNG. But in my judgment, looking at the data, there is room to purchase additional CNG buses as we go forward in the future. And we're going to bring back our recommendation to the board.
I'm glad you're looking at that, and I'll be with you just a minute. We have now a lot of data on this for a while,
yes.
And it seems to me it's been very consistent for quite a while. So, you know, one of the questions is just why are these hybrids not getting better? I mean, it does seem like it's some of the most promising technology. Everybody's interested in the country. It's now in a fairly high level of production. The price hasn't come down on the buses, and their performance isn't going up. So I look forward to that report. Just, though, as a matter of pure statistics, what strikes me is that that's at a level of, say, 5,700. The next worst is the old diesel buses, which are far less, far poorer performers than everything else except the hybrid. There, according to this on slide 9, is page 9, is 7,500. And yet we have a fleet average of, 6,317? And that's what I don't understand. How can those numbers come up to that one when the only one that's below is hybrid and we have fewer hybrids? Hybrids will be contributing less to poor performance simply because there are so few of them. How many hybrids we got in service now? 100?
Yeah.
Do you remember how many hybrids we have at the
moment? We have 50. At that point, we have 50 hybrids.
Well, that's right, because some of them wouldn't have gotten into service. So that I just ask you to check the numbers on that, because it just doesn't look like it could average out that way.
I think the numbers just might reflect the CNG hybrids and the clean diesels, but I'll look at
No, because then the number would be higher. The thing is, it's way too low.
I suspect it's the other fleet, but they will look into
Mr. Jim Colvin, Mr.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Zimmern. Your train of questions exactly where I was headed with this as well. If you go to the page 10, you'll see the reasons for the failures. I'm really concerned and would ask the general manager and staff to comment on, are we dealing with warranty items here on these buses that are breaking down? That's one question. Secondly, are we dealing with the fact that hybrids require different kinds of training, and maybe we haven't got a well-trained staff to maintain these buses? Maybe they're missing certain things. And so I'd like you to comment on that, whether you can do it now or with a report, that's fine.
Let me just say a couple of things. If you look at the average, the year-to-date average for the hybrids, it's 10,500. If you look at just the month of March, all the fleets went down in performance, and the reason for that was because of the first week we had, if you recall, several storms, snowstorms, and that affects the performance of all the buses. Regarding training, when we purchase the buses, we purchase training packages so that our instructors are trained by the factory, and we offer the training to our mechanics. But you may be right, because we have so many hundreds of mechanics, and we can't put them all through the training all in one shot. So there's a learning curve for that as well.
What about the warranty question? Is the engine failures due to warranty issues?
They are, unless it's something that we did or some other natural cause.
So you're saying we maybe have some defective products?
I'm not saying that. We have had defective products. I am not sure that that was the cause here. The main cause here for this month, if you're looking at this month, was because of the bad weather and valves freezing up, bellows freezing up, ignition modules, things of that nature.
And which manufacturer have we purchased these buses from?
Most of the CNG buses are New Flyers. We have purchased some North American Bus Industries, but those are the articulators that are out in the street.
Thank you.
But the engines are the same in all of the vehicles, no matter who manufactures the buses. Is that true?
Yeah. Or at Bill Allison. Or Allison's.
Cummins engines, all his transmissions.
Proceed. I'm sorry, Mr. Benjamin, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we had this discussion about hybrids many months ago, and the fact that their performance was so much lower. At that time, we said that there were some essentially burn-in problems, some initial issues associated with how these buses were showing up, and we were going through and we were fixing them, and they would be improved quickly. Clearly, that hadn't happened. Is there something different going on here? We must have some sense as to why these are continuing to perform so poorly.
Go ahead. Mr. Victoria is the expert in maintenance. My expertise in just talking to people and my intuitive belief on certain things. And looking at it, the hybrid buses are far more complex from an electronic standpoint. So it takes a different skill set to maintain those vehicles versus maintaining a diesel or a CNG bus. And it gives you opportunities for greater problems, electronic problems. The second issue, even though the technology is perfected, it's very good for automobiles, for buses. As I look around the country, I've not seen numbers better than this. So it's not an issue of just Ramada employees. It's an issue throughout the country of this technology. It's similar to what CNG buses went through in the first couple of years, bad performance. They would break down more often than the diesel buses. But having said that, I think over time you're going to have a better performing product. I'm not so sure that's the right product for now. I'm always concerned when we're in the forefront of technology, and particularly when you get the same emissions reductions from CNG versus hybrids. I like to stay with a product that works, that's more reliable. So that's why I'm going to be making recommendations to the board on some changes for our future purchases, that we continue with the clean air fleet, but there be a blend of hybrids and CNGs. But I don't know when we're going to start seeing these numbers go up. I do recall in my career going through the same issue with CNG for about 4 to 5 years before the numbers started to improve.
So you're saying that the period that it takes for the new technology to get past its initial problems and for staff to be able to understand how to maintain it is on the order of years, not on the order of months?
Yes. One of the issues is the number of vehicles. If you look across the country, it's not like automobiles, you know, where you sell 50 to 100,000 engines, and so there's a lot of research. It's only a few thousand buses sold every year. And of those few thousand, a smaller number of those are hybrid vehicles. So there's technology that really doesn't have a large amount of dollars going into it from a development standpoint, nor a production standpoint. And so the period of time it takes to work out the bugs is a lot longer.
And you were about to say something earlier, and I think it's an important thing as you do your next report, and that is, yes, on a per unit basis, the CNGs do cost less than the hybrids to purchase, but you also have to add in the capital cost of
the
providing the fueling facilities, which we've discovered can be extremely high in any given circumstance.
Yes.
And Mr. Victoria, it looks like he wants to tell us a little bit more about where these problems are really occurring.
I do. If you just look at the month of March, it was a terrible month for all fleets. And you can see how it affected all of them, but in particular, you can look at the hybrid. If you annualize the whole thing, if you look at the patterns for the entire chart, you'll see that the performance has been pretty consistent, up and down. 1,500 miles is normal and typical. But again, March, it was a really bad month.
Is there anything that you know of? I mean, obviously, you're keeping track of the fact that these buses are not performing well. Is there anything in particular that you know of that's causing them not to perform as well, or is it just different things constantly popping up?
Let me ask Phil Wallace to come up and address that. He's got the information. Phil Wallace is our head of bus maintenance.
Thank you, sir. Good morning,
Mr. Wallace.
I had the pleasure of talking to this group some months ago, about the clean fleet technologies and what's going on in the industry. Cummins is the only engine in town, be it CNG, be it clean diesel, be it hybrid. There's other engines out there that are being looked at. For the month of March, we had one hybrid-related failure of 30. It was a dual-power module that converts alternating current to direct current and back. The rest of them were primarily engine-related issues. Cut-off won't start, check engine lights. The majority of those, unfortunately, we're still working very hard with Cummins to find out their mysteries. The bus will cut off, we'll get out there, we'll diagnose it. We've got six buses in the fleet right now that we've got black boxes on trying to get data. Cummins has been very supportive in trying to narrow this down. But it's not hybrid-related issues. We have had no battery failures. Early on, we did have some EV drive issues that were quickly addressed by Allison. It was a bearing failure, which is basically the same bearing that's used in an Allison transmission. Main harness failures, we've had none. We briefed you some months ago as well. We did have a control harness failure. That's been replaced by Allison. We have not had any repeat failures. Everything is moving down to this engine. This, by the way, is the same engine that we're now purchasing in our latest 22 compressed natural gas buses. It's the same platform. It's an ISL engine. We're really struggling with this engine. We've got about seven fleet failures on the 22 Navvies right now. The best engine in my 36 years here was the 8.3 gas engine. It can't buy it anymore. It doesn't meet the clean air standards. As Mr. Cato briefed, we want to come back. We want to get the bugs out of this ISL engine. It's the only game in town. We've got to. Be it clean diesel, be it hybrid, be it CNG. We're working with the manufacturer to get the bugs out. We've got some retrofits planned on the CNG fleet. We think that long term, when we come back to you with the numbers, that CNG is the direction to go. Because it's not over yet. We're going to see different configuration changes in engines in 2010 and different configurations in engines in 2013. So it's a moving target and trying to find the technology that we could. And training's not an issue. We've had great training, support from Allison and the New Flyer folks that have manufactured these buses. We would have never gone down a hybrid path if we knew we could continue to buy 8.3 gas engines and had the money to convert our facilities. That's the bottom line. But we didn't have the money to convert facilities, and the 8.3 is no longer available.
Mr. Wallace, let me just make sure I understand what you said. What I thought you said was the problem was the engine, not the stuff that goes around the engine.
Correct.
And that the same engines used for diesel, for CNG, and for hybrid.
It's the same basic ISL Cummins platform, same engine.
And so if we buy new vehicles, regardless of what we buy, we're looking at potentially this very same problems?
Similar problems. Some variances from CNG to hybrid to clean diesel are not exactly alike. For instance, on the 22 Navvies that we've just put in service at Bladensburg, gas buses, we're having major problems with them, and we haven't even pressed them into full service yet because of the X-line construction. We're using them very sparingly. I think we've averaged about 6,000 mean distance between failures. That's using them sparingly. But we're in a fleet failure mode on turbochargers, humidity sensors, a list of six or seven items that we'd be happy when we come back to you next month to give you an overview that we're working with Cummins on. And we work very closely with LA. They're running more of these new ISL gas than anybody else in the property. Turbochargers, EGR coolers, piston failures, spark plug failures, turbine inlet sensor failures, humidity sensor failures.
Stop you for a second before you go through all that.
I'm telling you, it's very sobering.
What I think I hear you telling us is that we have the wrong comparison up there. The issue is not CNG versus diesel versus hybrid. What we ought to be looking at is the old engine versus the new engine.
And again, it's a moving target because what the new engine tomorrow is not going to be the new engine the next day because the certs are going to change in 10. We're pretty comfortable we know where 10 is going to get us. And in 13, here we go again.
Okay, so when we buy a whole bunch of new buses, regardless of what they are, we're expecting a substantially lower level of performance, at least initially.
Initially. We had early problems with the 8.3 gas, and we worked through them. And again, it's the best engine I've seen in my time here at the authority.
Right. But I do think that's a really important issue. It says that we ought to be tracking on this thing, what is the new engine doing versus the old engine, as opposed to what is this fleet versus that fleet doing.
Well, just a point of clarification, if I could, too, now. Just so we're all clear on what we're reporting here, CNG, hybrid, and clean diesel. We were fortunate here at WMATA in that in a year and a half span, we purchased all three of the latest technologies, so we felt it was apples to apples. So the older fleet has CNG buses in it. It's any bus that was purchased prior to 2004. So that's
Oh, wait a minute. Now, you're saying the CNG number isn't all our CNG buses?
It's all the CNG buses that were purchased since 2004.
Okay, well, now we have a major data reporting problem, because that's not what any of this data we've been seeing has ever shown. It does not say that it says CNG. Those are supposedly all the CNG buses. Mr. Francis, get your data straight. We need to know what it is we're looking at when we see it. If there's CNG buses that aren't in there, and that's not all the CNG buses, then you shouldn't be presenting it as a...
Well, I'll take the hit for that, sir, because, you know, initially we answered it that way, and we'll make that correction. But I think it's really important...
Okay, so we clearly do need a distinction between age and type of the fleet. However, I would still contend that having looked at this data now, month after month after month, for years, we actually know that the CNG fleet outperforms all the others, because it does so consistently over time, so that any of those age issues would have ironed out. It's not simply an age issue here. We have some technologies that perform better than others. And I think Mr. Cato got that, you know, he put his finger right on that, that in the early days of CNG, there was real bad performance because it was new and all that. Things had to be worked out, and you didn't have the volumes level, all the things he was saying. And I have to think, for me and Mr. Graham, this has got to be one of those moments, as that great American philosopher Yogi Berra says, deja vu all over again. Because we remember sitting here, I don't know anyone else who was necessarily here that many years ago now, when we had people from the U.S. Department of Energy sitting right over there telling us this, saying hybrids are very promising technology for the future. But it is a prototype still, and you need to understand that. And it's going to be a lot of years before the numbers are up, before you work out all these bugs, and it isn't going to perform at that level. They sat there and told us that. There were people on this side of the table who didn't want to hear it. And we're now seeing it played out. The general manager saying exactly what we were told. I don't know how many years ago that is now, Jim, but, you know, we have heard this. We know that when you bring in something new, there's this period of working it out. It's true with our rail cars and everything else. Understand that. That's an initial period. Then you get stuff worked out, and you get to the point where it performs as well as it's ever going to perform. And then it gets old, and it starts declining again. Am I right, Mr. Wallace?
Yes, sir.
And that's why you see the performance on the older fleet, because it's older. But it still leaves the question of why some of our newest vehicles, some of which those hybrids have been on the road for a while now, it is consistently, March may have been worse than other months, but it's consistently performing at a lower level. And one thing that we haven't said here, but I assume you're looking at as well, is how do yours perform compared to the other ones in the cities that are running them as well? My guess is we see something similar, because it's consistent with everything I've heard, but I assume you'll be checking that as
well. Very similar to SEPTA, very similar to King County on the West Coast.
Mr. Zimmerman, let me respectfully disagree with you. I think what I've heard is there are two different engines. The buses that have larger numbers of the older engine tend to perform better than the buses that have larger numbers of the new engine. And what we're looking at is in the hybrid fleet, 100% of the new engines. No. That's where our problem is.
The hybrids out for a couple of years now.
Isn't it? Don't
the
all
ISL engine, that was the first group of buses, those 50 that we got.
So what we're looking at is the difference between engines, not the difference between technologies. And what we need to do is work through the problems of this engine, which affect all of the fleets. And in between, what we're getting is a set of numbers that are biased by how many of which engine each fleet has.
We will be clearer in the report that we give you next month, because we would deal specifically with the issues of technology, what fuels do we recommend, and the issues of the engine. So we bring all that back.
And we're going to see that in June?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Yes.
Good. Look forward to it. All right. You want to wrap up the this part of the...
Okay. We'll leave off there.
That's all right. I think you're up to Metro Rail.
All right, I think we're at Metro Rail. So Metro Rail for the month of March, its on-time performance was 93%, and that was with a 15% increase in ridership due to special events that month. And also we had a speed restriction that we had over the Grosvenor Bridge, and we were still able to maintain at 93%. Next slide. One of the things I wanted to point out was some highlights in Metro Rail, as you can see, with the four bullet points. But the one I wanted to particularly let the committee know, that the second bullet point, a knock at your door, was a video that was shot here at Metro, and Mr. Kubitschek and his team and Assistant General Superintendent Clay Bunning did an excellent job in working with the FTA and the National Transportation Safety Board. This was all geared toward right-of-way safety. It's also going to be a video that's going to be shown around the country with different transit agencies, too. But it went over work rules and procedures on how to safely work in the right-of-way. The next slide is Metro Access. Metro Access on-time performance for the month of March was at 92%. and you can see the late was 7.5. And one of the things I wanted to point on here from a customer's impact is that with Mr. Ken and his team are taking a look at enhancing dispatcher training to make sure that we have better coordination between the drivers and the dispatchers as well. Next slide. And one of the highlights that you probably read in the news media was for Metro Access on the Easy Pay. It started on May the 1st. Okay. Next slide. This is our escalator availability. Our escalator availability for the month of March was at 89.4%. A lot of that was attributed to unscheduled. You see, the unscheduled maintenance was 7.5% on the failures, and that was due to stoppage at times. What we explained to the committee, we have comb plate and maybe steps from these escalators that shut down the escalator where we have to restart. And a lot of that was geared toward that. And the preventative maintenance for the month, you can see, was about 3% as well.
That's the unscheduled number.
Yes.
Okay. A question that,
it's a disturbing trend. Is that, are we getting more of that or what? What's happening here? Ever since January, it seems to.
We've been pretty constant at around 91-92% for a while. For the month of March, it's just we incurred a lot more failures than what we normally do.
Anything particular or just random?
Just random.
Okay, and I guess because January was high, it makes that slope look a little bit greater. Okay. Well, I guess we got to keep tracking that because it's an ominous slope.
We will.
It's striking, though, that the 2008 number was pretty much, you know, it was a good year, right? Above goal, and you know, we're running consistently below it this year. And that to me is the most striking thing, more so than the drop in March, which we know is a crappy month for lots of things, much of it I'm sure weather related. But
as Mr. Victoria pointed out earlier too, the month of March wasn't a very good month.
Right, but that's what I'm saying, is the part that bugs me is that the whole line is below last year. I mean, do you have a sense of why that is?
I don't, but I can bring that back to the committee. I'll take a look at that. And
you know, I mean, yeah. When you notice something like that, you think, is there something going on? Is it because it's 1 year older and that's a critical year since we did an initial major? I mean, I don't know.
Let me ask Mr. LaCoste if he's come across anything that's abnormal for that. The whole year.
Just the whole red line, the whole below, the whole blue line. It just looks like this year is consistently performing like last year.
The major reason that the numbers are down more in 09 than in 08 is a reflection of the additional CIP units that we are doing, and that number is any unit.
CIP
unit? I'm sorry, MOD rehabs. The rehab units. And that number is included in the availability number.
So we have reduced availability because of more stuff we're doing. So
right,
the pie below looks different for this year than it does for last year. We would see that if you showed the pie
right.
in 2008 up there. Okay, well, that makes sense. We're taking more of them out. So that doesn't actually indicate anything about performance. It indicates something about what the customer sees, but it doesn't indicate
right.
something about the performance of the equipment.
And the major impact for March was we had maybe 4 days, and I don't know the exact dates, but there was a major snowstorm in March that hit us pretty hard.
I think you've answered my question. Thank you. Carry on.
I'm up on my next slide. Okay. Before we move on, Mr. Zimmerman, I noticed you and I had a conversation, but the committee might also have noticed that there's red, white, and blue signs going up in our bus stops, and that's for us in preparation of getting ready for the next bus in July. I've asked Ms. Peck if she can give us a quick briefing.
Let me ask you a question. I actually was surprised to hear the story about signs going up when I saw the release and all that, because the signs never went down at any of my bus stops. I mean, we put out thousands of them, and we didn't take any down as far as I knew. So what is this about 12,000 bus stops? Because
The only signs, Mr. Zimmerman, that were put up initially were for the pilot stops. There are 12,300 stops, only
total.
Several total.
Yeah.
only several hundred of those aluminum signs were put up originally. You are correct. They were not taken down.
Only several hundred?
Yes, only several hundred. Only the pilot areas had the signs, and so we had still 11,500 okay. signs to put up. We're putting up those signs in this month, and when we go live on July 1st, 12,300 signs, an aluminum sign, every bus stop will be up.
Well, I guess that answers the question. I just guess I didn't realize the degree to which the pilot hit all the places I go.
Yes.
It also didn't work any of the places I went, so I'm looking forward to it. First.
On the 8% of the routes, Mr. Victoria pointed out to me correctly, were up on the pilot.
But they managed to get buses I take a lot of.
Yeah. Because that's how we did the pilot.
Yeah, actually, the first part of that is the 16 line, which was one of the original ones because it's one of the heaviest lines. And also it was, I guess, up on the 38th and Roslyn Ballston corridor, so I see those. But okay, so tell me what we're going to do.
Okay, so I have a single page of facts that I think might answer any question, any rollout questions that you have, and I'd be glad to
answer. So you're going to give us a single page then?
So I'd just give you a single page rather than clear a lot of the questions and then proceed from there. The Next Bus initiative is providing customers with real-time predictions of Next Bus arrivals on 183 lines and 335 routes, and as I just mentioned to you, 12,300 individual
stops. And it deploys on July 1?
It will be fully deployed on July 1 at all of those 12,000 stations.
And we're scheduled to hear something about this at our June meeting?
June meeting, correct.
Yes.
So, you know, without trying to do a whole lot now, just given that obviously it's out there in the public, if there are any questions from committee members now, feel free to ask them. Otherwise, we'll look forward to receiving the fact sheet that you're going to send us. And we'll look forward to the full discussion at next month's meeting. Any questions? Thank you very much. All right, we done with that? We ready to go on to the main event? We have an action item. The Retail Services Demonstration Program. Not the food vending item, the Retail Services Demonstration Program. Despite what you may have heard. Who's making the presentation, Mr. Cato?
I'm Ned Fallingheim, that will make the presentation along with...
Thank you, Mr. Victoria.
And Dr. Monomy.
Good morning, Mr. Fallingheim. Mr. Monomy.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. The next slide. So, recommending the board approve today a request for, that we issue a request for proposals for a retail demonstration program, 5 one-year options for minimum of 12 Metro Rail stations. Background to this is that several years ago we issued a request for proposals, retail services at 12 metro stations. At that time, we did not allow proposals that included food, tobacco, or alcohol, and we only received 3 proposals at the time, all of which were unsatisfactory and all of which were rejected. We were directed at the time to investigate retail uses that we could offer at our stations, and one important thing to note about the investigation and the finding over the last couple of years is that packaged food and beverages and newsstands are the most lucrative opportunities for vendors and obviously the most challenging for us in terms of our system policies. What we're proposing at this time is to solicit for master licensees who would operate a minimum of one site at each of 12 stations that we've identified and vetted. We are looking for the licensee to handle all of the retail offerings at all of the stations. But any site not awarded to a master licensee, we'd also like to be make available to small businesses. One of the very important policies of the board, across the board, is to support small and local businesses in the region. And we want to make sure that all master licensees may have the wherewithal to make investments in these stations, that they are including small businesses and local businesses in their proposals, and also that we are offering, independent of the master licensees, opportunities to offer carts and locations at any of our stations. We have identified a number of sites. Basically, we at the, excuse me, at the 12 stations. At the 12 stations that we've identified, we have identified potential locations, whether in the paid area, within the mezzanines, or outside of our stations in the Kiss and Ride areas, that we've tentatively identified as being relatively free of operational constraints. And that is the basis for the selection of these 12 stations, in addition to which we've also identified stations that we think have a minimum level of ridership that supports a marketable offering. For this RFP, we are continuing to affirm the prohibition of the sale of alcohol and tobacco consumption, alcohol and tobacco sale, and we are affirming that the prohibition on food and drink consumption in the system will continue. But we are requesting proposals for both fixed structures, kiosks that would sell either non-food or food items, and mobile vending carts that would also offer, potentially offer the same thing. The stations that we, 12 stations we have identified are located in all three jurisdictions. We are going to insist in the RFP that the proposals submitted to us include all kinds, address the operational impacts associated with trash removal and keeping clean stations and maintaining safety. We want them to be fully responsible for that. One of our important principles is that there not be a negative fiscal impact to us associated with cleaning trash. We've already seen that issue with newspapers. We want to give a vendor, selected licensee, 3 years to, which we've determined from is sort of a standard doing other retail programs around the country. It gives vendors an opportunity to amortize the costs of investing in a structure in our station. We would like to be able to offer in the RFP 5 one-year renewable options for a total term of 8 years. And we'd also like to give the, not limit the proposals to the 12 stations. We're actually opening up for the system for proposals at any station. The only thing we can say is that we've tentatively identified locations at each of the 12 stations we're offering that we think work operationally. We haven't reached that same determination for the remaining stations in our system, but we're welcoming proposals, and we would review the operational impacts of the proposals made to us after after receipt of proposals. So we have had a number of meetings internally to vet these stations. We've run the proposal past the Riders Advisory Council. There have been, I think, many articles in the press since that time identifying concerns about trash and enforcement of eating and drinking in the system. We're well aware of those issues, and our intent is really to come back subsequent to the receipt of proposals and review the proposals we received with the board and potentially the public as you all direct, so that we have an idea of whether we're striking the right balance between revenue, customer service, and system policy issues. Next stage just gives some examples of some of the locations that we've identified. At Metro Center, we've identified a location in the paid area of the mezzanine that we believe is out of the way of pedestrian traffic there. King Street, we've identified a free area of the mezzanine. Exterior locations, Fort Totten, along the sidewalks next to the bus bays there, or New Calton, similarly outside the entrance there on the south side, and short-term parking in Vienna. And we also wanted to illustrate the kinds of kiosks that you see around the country in other locations to give a sense of, just what they look like. And I think it's fair to say that these are attractive structures. And our recommendation is that you approve the issuance of a request for proposals as described here.
All right, before we go to questions. This was a note discussed at the Riders Council. I don't believe Ms. Zinkel is here yet, but I think we do have a member, Mr. Albert. I wonder if you could briefly share with us some of the discussion that the Riders Council had before we begin our own discussion, just to summarize the kind of views that were expressed. I know there wasn't necessarily a consensus on one thing, but...
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and other members of the board. My name is David Alpert. I'm one of the members of the Riders Council representing the District of Columbia. As you heard, we did discuss this this proposal at the Riders Council meeting, and there were a wide variety of different opinions. Personally, I'm very optimistic about this proposal and about the opportunity to provide people who spend a great deal of time in metro stations with opportunities to buy services that they need, goods that they might need, and raise revenue for Metro by doing so. Members of the Riders Council expressed a variety of comments. Some suggested some great possible opportunities for goods or services that they would need. Mr. DiBernardo from Maryland, for example, talked about how he, on his commute, takes a bus and then a train and then another bus, and has no opportunities to pass any post offices, and that perhaps opportunities to mail letters or buy stamps would be very useful to him. We had a variety of other specific comments, and I think that the general thing to take from that is that we very much hope that staff will cast a very wide net to try to find a lot of potential vendors of different industries. You know, people talked about flower merchants. I mean, all sorts of things that maybe are even outside the box of what we might have otherwise think about. Members also did express concerns about two specific areas. One was food. Not everyone felt that food would be problematic, but there was definitely a lot of trepidation about whether a program that included food would lead to more eating and drinking on Metro, which everyone unanimously does not want to, there to actually be more trash on the system. In addition, people, a variety of people were concerned about whether by focusing on the master licensee, it would diminish the opportunities for smaller businesses, potentially minority-owned or disadvantaged businesses, veterans-owned businesses, that sort of thing, to participate. Mr. Bonheimer explained, and it's in the presentation here, that staff is soliciting proposals from not only the master licensee but others, and that as far as the food goes, this is an opportunity to sort of collect information about what are the trade-offs between having food or not having food, what would be the relative amounts of revenue that would be received, what would be the potential risks. Personally, I feel that collecting more information is good, and I think it would be a good idea for staff to go ahead with a very wide RFP and collect as much information as possible. But members of the RAC and advocacy groups did express some concern that if we went ahead and did that, then maybe there wouldn't be a chance for people to later weigh in about the issues about food or the issues about small businesses. And so what I've talked to Mr. Bonheimer about this as well, and I would urge the board to essentially release the information about as much as possible that doesn't break any sort of competitive confidentiality issue with the vendors. Release as much information as possible once we have all this data. We're going to learn about how much we could potentially get from food versus not food, or how much we might get more from small businesses versus master licensees. Let's let people know about that. Let's let the readers of the Washington Post and the Examiner who've written letters in, and there's a good column in the Dr. Ridlock column, for example, about how people felt about food. Let's let those people know what Metro might give up if it didn't do food, and then be able to comment in a more informed way about that. I hope that we can do that, and I very much hope that this program will be successful.
Thank you. That's very helpful summary, Mr. Robert. Appreciate it. Now we'll open up to members. There's a lot of issues here. Mr. Graham, why don't you lead us on?
Thank you very much. First, let me express my relief to see this, because some of us, several of these members, have been asking for this for year after year after year, and we've had this kind of period of being in the doldrums on this issue for the last 3 years. And some of us were puzzled, and we couldn't understand what happened to something which this board had heretofore authorized to proceed. So, but we won't look back. We'll look forward and say that I'm just very happy to see this program coming before us. I have a couple of questions. Everybody's going to be concerned about the food items package. You say that you're going to continue the prohibition against consumption of food and drink. I'm very concerned, and I know this will be the subject of thorough discussion, so I'm not going to go on and on, but I'm very concerned that once we open this door, it just is going to sway wider and wider and never be able to close. and that we're going to end up with food and drink consumption unless you find a way to package these things where the food items can't be unpackaged by human beings or something. I don't know. I went through a thing on the D.C. Council about taking a bottle of wine out of a restaurant on the assumption that it was packaged and securely packaged so that you wouldn't be drinking it on the sidewalk. I was never satisfied, but I was in the minority on that subject. The second area of concern to me is the small business participation. I have always seen this as a small business opportunity. And, you know, I see that you are have tentative things. I'm a little bit surprised if you didn't consult with, maybe you consulted with others, but I suspect you didn't, about the specific locations and both within the stations and the stations themselves. I would ask Mr. Cato if you would give me the assurance that the board members from the jurisdictions would be consulted on those issues.
We will consult with you on those issues.
Because I see it's all tentative. But I'm very concerned about the small business. Excuse me. I'm very concerned about the small business dimension of this, because I really saw this as an opportunity for some of our little guys to really get in on this. And of course, I don't want this to be away from pedestrian traffic. I want it to be in the middle of pedestrian traffic, to the extent to which it's safe. But I want and so these master. What do you call them? These master license concerns me a great deal. Because I can close my eyes and I can imagine, I'm not going to mention any particular company, but I read several immediately come to mind that are going to control this. And I know this is the ease, this represents a certain amount of ease for Metro, but I don't think, the objective of this program is not to provide convenience to Metro staff. The objective of this program is to provide small business opportunities and provide our riding public with the ability to buy certain items. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm not ready to support a plan that has master licenses in the way this has been described. I want to see the little businesses having a clear shot at being able to come and do this. And that may mean, by the way, a consideration of Metro actually establishing a kiosk, a uniform kiosk, that people can then rent rather than saying, what do you guys want to do? Because that may be beyond the ability of some small businesses. But let's recast this so that we get the small businesses front and center with this opportunity.
Seems to me you've raised three general issue areas. One, of course, is the food question. Second is the location of the sites. And the third is the sort of master license approach as opposed to letting small folks just come in and take a spot or something like that. Did I cover your major issues?
No, I want to state the third one the way you stated.
Okay.
I'd say I want this program to clearly focus on being an opportunity for small business enterprise. And the master licensee is not going to nurture that to the extent that I'd like to see it happen.
Okay. I thought that's what I said, but thank you for restating it. I think that's a good delineation of the issues, and I find myself pretty much in agreement with Mr. Graham personally. Maybe we can kind of concentrate on those. If there's any issues there beyond, I mean, those things seem to me to be the three big issues in here, but there may be others. So if members have others they want to raise, let's put them on the table, and maybe we can work through each of them.
Mr. Chairman?
Sorry.
If I may, our intent as staff was to cast as wide as possible. As Board Member Graham suggested, I think we want to actively solicit the small and local businesses. We do not want to exclude them at the outset. We want
Let
to
me hear from some of the members.
Okay, sure.
I just wanted you to be a little clearer on what you will be defining in this master licensee process, such that the information that we get back should give us some informed, be able to make an informed decision as to what level of providers might we see. I think I want to echo Mr. Graham's point that I think there's the opportunity for us increasing those folks who are participating in the small and minority businesses, and I think that's an important thing. I think one of the issues here is that we have a lot of adjacent uses outside of stations but are not station properties. So the question is, are we going to make an effort to ensure that we bring those folks in rather than exclusively on that? And that would be one of my concerns, to make sure. The other one is on the food consumption piece. And I think with the food consumption piece is the part that I think many of us have echoed before, and that is greater information about the prohibition. I think this is going to introduce to people, okay, what else can we do here? There are things we can do. The point is, I think we have another role that needs to come along with this that talks about the enforcement piece as well as information. You know, you can consume an item on the Metro from Washington to Virginia and never hear an announcement about food. And so this will give people, I think, maybe a thought that that's where we're going, but it's an ample opportunity for us to reinforce the fact that we have a prohibition and we're continuing it even as we move forward with this. So that's what I would hope that we can get out of.
In fact, Ms. Hudgens, you could take any trip you wanted anywhere in the system, not hear an announcement of food, because we don't do an announcement of food. I actually asked for the announcement schedule to see what was rotating in, because all I ever hear is, you know, is that your bag and stuff like that, the utility of which I question. But so I got the list that runs on like a 3-minute interval or so, and it's, you know, theft, wash your hands, is that your bag, elevator outages, let others exit, first time safety, see it, say it, door safety, elevator outages, theft, and so on and so forth. In fact, this is not something that's been part of our communications campaign on the announcements. A few years ago, I mean, this seems to go in a cycle, right? Every few years people say, nobody's enforcing the eating and drink thing, and then the agency does something about it. We had a pretty significant you know, poster visual ad campaign just a few years ago that was quite effective. People said, ew, when they saw some of the images, which was the effect they were trying to get. But that's gone away again. So I do think this is a point that a lot of writers have been making in comments I've seen on the blogs and in letters we get, that there's a feeling that we're not doing anything at the moment. And, you know, we went from one point doing some draconian things, and now we seem to not being doing anything at all. And it's, I think, interesting that having raised this issue, as staff has, unhelpfully, I thought, with this retail question, we've now opened up this whole area. And I do believe we're going to need to come one way. Whatever we're doing on this, we need to do something about this question about communicating, especially in a highly transient area, what the rules are, so those who don't understand will know, because it is clear that our riders appreciate the fact that they don't have other people's coffee dropped on them when they're riding our system. Let's see, Mr. Giancola, we'll just keep working around.
Yeah, I want to thank you, Mr. Zimmerman. I want to support certainly what Mr. Graham said about the 3 points he made, but I'm more interested in talking about the food issue. Again, I am a daily rider of Metro, and while the people I have polled, you know, at the office as well as on the trains have indicated that they have a lot of misgivings about the food, they all recognize, at least this is what I'm hearing, that food comes on the Metro now. And there's a lot of vendors already outside many Metro stations. Certainly yesterday when I was at about 3 or 4 different stations around town, there's vendors outside those stations. So food is coming on, and my concern is a companion program to stress the enforcement. And what I've read is that we give warnings. We give a lot of warnings before we give a ticket out. And it'd be interesting to know, have we ever given many tickets out? And the issue is, I personally, and as a daily rider of Metro and the Red Line, have really never seen a security policeman on the trains that I'm on. I think I see one once every 100 rides. I see a security policeman on the trains. During the times when I have to come in a little earlier or later to work, particularly when the students are on the trains, the students, in my view, are the worst violators of the eating rule. Yet there doesn't seem to be any enforcement either at the station entrance when the kids are coming in with their bottles and their sandwiches or their whatever, and or going on the station or on the train itself. So, again, we have to really beef up the enforcement. I'd be of the view that to be more strict in the enforcement, issuing more tickets rather than less. So that's where I would be coming from on this. But, again, maybe the solution is that we solicit or a set-aside, a small business set-aside master license concept. So that may be something you may want to think about.
Some comments?
I also support Mr. Graham's 3 areas and would like to explore them further. I do think that this is a good concept. And in particular, I see it as a customer service something we are doing to assist our customers to conveniently find the kinds of things that they want to buy, either going to or from their various destinations. And I think in many cases, people bring in dry cleaning, which clearly wouldn't be processed on site, and then picking it up and taking it home, those kinds of things are really, really useful. And the idea of a post office, small post office or vending system there makes a great deal of sense. I am concerned, first of all, about the idea of using kiss and ride and short-term parking spaces. I didn't know we had an excess of those. And so I'd like to reiterate Mr. Graham's request that in any jurisdiction, you please get together with the board members associated with that jurisdiction so that we can determine whether that would be an appropriate thing to do. There may be some locations where we have an excess of those spaces, but I'm not aware of them in my jurisdiction, at least, and in many of the places that I travel. I don't really understand what a food item package to discourage consumption is. Could you explain that to me?
I think the concept here is that we're going to make clear that we're discouraging consumption. You're right. I can't tell you exactly what that is. We're going to have to see what the industry offers, and the thing we're going to need to do is just emphasize we don't want people eating in the system. We may make some suggestions that, you know, could be frozen foods, things like that. Give them some examples to illustrate it, but I think we're going to have to pick and choose from among what the industry offers and be weighing the issues and guidelines that you're giving us today.
So are we going to specifically say this one's okay and that one's not? I don't understand how we're going to implement
this. I don't think we're intending to say that now and before the solicitation, but I think we want to review it with the board and potentially with the public after we receive those proposals so that we can make that judgment with as much input as we can get.
I mean, I don't.
What it is not is someone selling ice cream cones or hot dogs or Cokes, you know, to our customers. What we're looking for is some type, if we accept any of it, would be a type of vendor that would have pre-prepared meals to take home, but not the type that you could eat right away. You would have to heat it up. It would be in a frozen state or some other state that most individuals would not consume at that moment. But again, we won't know that until we get proposals. We would not recommend any food products that we feel will cause additional eating on the system. But vendors are very creative. Businesses are very creative. Again, our intent is to take food out of the system, not to bring it in. And we don't know what that is yet until we get the proposals. But I can tell you right now, it's not a hot dog vendor downstairs past the fair gates that people could have hot dogs that they would take through the system.
I'm hearing sort of I know it when I see it type answer coming out of you. You know, I know which things are not okay. And certainly the concept of having an item that is a prepared dinner that I can take home and heat up when I get home makes a lot of sense also. I just don't know how you prevent that from being the same thing coming in. And frozen food is great, but frozen food includes prepackaged ice cream. You know, and where do you draw that line? How do we do this bid so that we make it abundantly clear to our bidders, the people who are responding, that ice cream that isn't prepackaged is not okay, and so is ice cream that is prepackaged because you can open it up. How do we make sure that we say, yeah, a hot dog is not okay, but a prepackaged sandwich is also not okay? And where do we draw those lines, and how do we get a bid that's meaningful when we get done with this process? I'm concerned that what we're going to end up doing here is increasing our enforcement, which I agree with Mr. Giancola, we probably ought to increase anyway, so much that any revenue we get out of this is going to be lost in the increased enforcement, and then we're going to have bad public relations rather than good public relations. I would like to see this go forward with the public seeing this as a very positive move, not one in which they're now being ticketed and arrested because they bought from our own vendors or vendors on our facilities, and then we say, no, you can't eat that.
Mr. Chair, again, what we're proposing is a wide variety of items, stamps, dry cleaning, flowers, whatever the public sector can creatively come up with and recommend to us. We could exclude any item that's food. I mean, that can be decided by this board today, and we can remove that from the RFP. We were trying to make it as broad as possible, get some bids in, and get some proposals in, and then make that decision. But we can ultimately decide not to do that before we go out.
Mr. McKay?
Thank you. I generally agree with everything that's been said, and I think this is late in coming, not early, and I would hope that the issues that have come up are not going to be coming back to us 6 months from now, and 6 months later we get a bid, and it's a year from now that we get folks on the street, because I think our customers have waited a long time already, so I hope we can get these concerns addressed quickly. The two questions that I have is, in the demonstration program details, it mentions that we would be asking bidders to give us information on trash removal, station cleaning, and I guess what my concern is we have a lot of trash at our stations now, and we don't have vendors. And so how are we going to, in the RFP, suggest whose responsibility certain things are at these stations? That's my first question.
Just ask Mark Meister to ask him up.
Case-by-case basis, and we don't pretend to know this market at all, and you know, isn't that part of this process? We hope to learn how to address those kind of things.
Okay. Well, I would hope that part of this too is in dealing with our own staff. I mean, it's one thing for them to tell us what they think, but I also think that the station managers at these stations now are going to have an increased responsibility as well, and a level of awareness at least of what's happening. I think that goes without saying. And so, you know, to act like these will roll out one day without making sure our staff knows how to deal with issues that might come up with them, I think is going to be important. My concern with the locations, and I speak for the ones in Virginia, I don't want to take away any locations, but to me it would seem like if we want this program to be successful, we ought to be targeting first the stations that have no services, that are an island right now. And I think of Van Dorn, I think of Franconia Springfield, I think of Huntington, where a customer really can't walk anywhere in close proximity to get any of the services that are suggested here. Some of these stations that are listed have good transit-oriented development, and walking distance you can get many of these services. And so if we really want this to be successful, I think we should also be looking at criteria that says how convenient it is for our customers to get these services near the station. And I think there's a little bit of a disconnect there. I don't think we've necessarily targeted all the stations where success might be great because it's the only game in town. And I think that, you know, we should look at that in particular. And I also think the program will be successful if our stations aren't a mess. And so while I agree with what some folks have said about packaged foods, I also think that if we don't step up enforcement and use some of the revenue perhaps generated from this to deal with enforcement, we're going to have messy stations, and then we're going to have upset customers, and then the program will be a failure because nobody wants to see trash throughout the stations. And so a portion of the proceeds from this absolutely should be directed towards increasing enforcement. This might be an opportunity for us actually to increase the enforcement of existing rules that we already have. And actually the success of this program will be tied to whether we are successful keeping our stations clean where these programs are in place. So I would hope we would step up enforcement as a part of this.
Solid.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Carlton Sickles with all of you. It's all been said, but not everyone's said. Opportunity, I guess I should chime in. This is an action item, so I join Mr. Graham's comments. The emphasis should be, at least to some extent, to attract small businesses to participate. 12 stations, you pretty much would have to have a large capital investment if that was the criteria, but a smaller number of stations. And I know there was some language that you to before it goes out, it, there should be some language added to the action to emphasize participation.
If I may, one of the selection criteria in the RFP is inclusion of a small business on it, and proposals will be rated on that. They'll be weighted on that as well.
I understand and I appreciate that comment, but in the TOD, I mean, it makes sense because the projects are so big and a lot of these small companies just don't have the experience or the capital to do it. These type of kiosks and the type of items that are being proposed to be sold, small business certainly can have the experience and the capacity to do it. So from my point of view, I like the idea that they have to participate as a minority subcontractor to a majority person who wins the contract, just to, you know. So if we're voting on something like this today, I mean, that's my view. And then with respect to the stations in the jurisdiction, we certainly talk to both decisions. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I did want to emphasize that the proposal was not to be limited to the 12 stations. It was for a minimum of 12 stations. We are soliciting proposals for all 86 stations. It's just that the 12 are ones that we've vetted to this point. The remaining 74 we would need to look at once we get a proposal, but and work with the local jurisdictions as has been suggested.
I also find myself feeling, on the one hand, that, you know, I'm glad we're finally seeing this. We had thought we had something going and it disappeared and we weren't sure exactly what happened to it, and at the same time feeling like I hope we're not making a mistake at the outset to make something unsuccessful. I'm a little bit frustrated with the fact that, you know, 3 years ago we thought this was going somewhere, and we, you know, when we finally got around to, well, what happened to it? The answer was back that, well, we only got three proposals anyway, and they were unsatisfactory, and that, you know, the problem was we were prohibiting food sales, and, you know, I just fundamentally don't buy that at all. I mean, I just find that completely implausible, and I'm really unhappy about the fact that in order to get back to the question of retail in our stations, we had to open up the issue of food. I mean, I think that the food issue is one thing, and it's always fair to talk about, and, you know, it's fine to have that discussion, but it's a different issue. It's a separate issue, and we've confused the thing. And so what we don't have is what we first wanted. And while I have no doubt that if you ask people if they'd like to sell stuff, there's a whole lot of people that want to sell food. But there are people who sell things that don't happen to be food. They're out there now. And they sell umbrellas, and they sell newspapers, and they sell flowers, and they rent DVDs. And, you know, why can't we talk about that? And several months ago, while we were kind of leading up this, I sent around, copied the board members on something I sent to the general manager with a thing about this outfit that rents DVDs, you know, has vending machines that rent DVDs, because I have the same thing as everyone else has, I'm sure, 7-Elevens and grocery stores, and I sent this thing and said, gee, don't you think these people would like to have one of their boxes where thousands of people walk by every day? They have it, you know, in the grocery store. Wouldn't they be interested? I was going through some old papers over the weekend, and I found some old news clippings from several years back. And I found a thing I'd completely forgotten about that said the Metro Board was going to be discussing this actual company, same company that I sent the thing, which I won't name, but, you know, that the Metro Board was going to be discussing that here. Now, I didn't even remember the discussion, but there it was in the news from like 6, 7, 8 years ago or something like that. And I don't know whatever happened with that. So, number one, I don't understand why we can't do a solicitation that just excludes food. But then say, whatever that debate about food, maybe we'll have that at some point. But can't we first find out if somebody wants to sell people an umbrella at or near or in a metro station? Secondly, the question of the locations, which is much of what, you know, Mr. Graham touched on in his second point, concerns me too. We got to have the right spots, but also the whole idea that we're sort of starting by focusing on a few little places that we're picking out. Now, it's one thing for us to pick places and say, this is acceptable, this is not acceptable. But on the other hand, I'd sort of like people to say, we want to be at this station or that station because the market will find its place. And I wonder if we're not restricting things a lot, which is part of that second issue. We only got three proposals.
I mean, I know I've had more than three people over the years come to me and say they'd like to do something like this, right? So there are people out there that want to do this. How can we open it up in a way that doesn't depend upon being, you know, some big savvy grant applicant type, which goes a little to the last point, but I think they're related, that if you have a program that is the way WMATA is mostly used to dealing with most of what we do, we buy big stuff from big folks, and there's elaborate procurement processes, and the people who apply are people with great departments that write these things. But this is really a small business kind of thing. And, you know, it certainly should be. I mean, someday maybe the board will be confronted with one outfit wants to come in and pay a lot of money for all these spaces. But if that was the case now, we'd already have that, and we'd be making revenue from it. To start the market may take establishing it, as often happens, by smaller independent businesses. But we don't seem to be set up in a way to invite that. And I see that there's been some effort to do that by saying, well, we're going to allow others to put in individual. But I still worry about whether we're really doing that, whether we really know how to make it possible for anybody that might want to run a cart, you know, as they might on a street or in the middle of a mall. We don't seem to be set up for that. I thought Mr. Graham's comment was interesting about if we had a standard thing that we could kind of offer, that might help. It might help with some other issues, too, because if anybody wants to come with their own stuff, you might have issues about whether you want that in the station, whether it looks right, all these other kind of things. I don't know. But I'd really like something that was, you know, more open in terms of entertaining proposals from individual small folks, of which we have many. I mean, there's much entrepreneurship out here in the Washington metropolitan area, to bring us some ideas, to try them on a short-term basis. You know, give anybody, I mean, that's the nice thing about dealing with somebody small, too. You don't have to give them a guaranteed contract with, you know, five option years or anything like that. You know, you can give them a short-term, and if you don't like it, you can kick them out. But, you know, maybe we find something. And I'd personally rather do that without getting into the issue of food and just put that off to another day. Now, in any case, there's obviously a lot of issues about this, and I don't know whether board members feel ready to act on this today. Mr. Graham.
Thank you very much. I want to thank everyone for their very thoughtful comments on this. You referred to this as the main event when you introduced it, but I'm not sure this is ready for prime time. You know, sometimes we get something in the committee and then it's on board meeting day, it goes right to the board and bang, you know. I hope we're not planning on doing that. You know, I want to on the food thing, I think I agree with the sentiment that's been expressed, which is I don't know how to have a unpackageable package, and you apparently don't either, and in terms of food stuff. And I want to remind the board members about the little girl at Friendship Heights, I think, who, a 12-year-old, who we arrested for a French fry. And that became an international story, much to, this was pre-John Cato, let me emphasize. But we did arrest a little girl with eating French fries, and it was horrendous. And so, you know, with great respect for your views, Mr. Giancola, when you say more enforcement, oh my God, you can just imagine where we're going to be led in terms of that. And I don't want to arrest little girls with French fries, and I suspect nobody here does either. So I think at a minimum we've got to take the food out of this. Just because maybe once we get an understanding of how umbrellas work, you know, or newspapers, you know, maybe we'll be ready for the bigger challenge of a candy bar. But I don't think we're there. I really don't think we're there. And Mr. McKay, thank you very much for your comment because I think you're right on target. It's fine Metro Center, it's fine Gallery Place, and there are a lot of people and so on. But there's also a lot of opportunities to buy an umbrella, you know. And I think the point you make is excellent. And I think of Georgia Avenue, where there's very little, Georgia Avenue, Petworth, where there's very little retail opportunity around the station. Yet there's a lot of people moving through this. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And then I think, not to take Gallery Place out, but to make sure that these stations are serviced is an excellent point. So, Mr. Chairman, I wonder whether... Could we pause on this for till the next meeting, and not adopt this today?
That's certainly an option for the committee. We could ask this to be brought back, perhaps with some reaction.
Would it be helpful if I move to postpone this?
Sure.
I will move to postpone this to the next meeting, and then we can work.
Motion by Mr. Graham, second by Mr. Solomon. In discussion on the motion. Thoughts? Mr. Giancola.
Do we want to have them bring back maybe some of the thoughts about small business and re-packaging, so to speak? The
I think we would want reactions to the various points raised, and hopefully some ways of addressing it in what might be approved at the next meeting if this motion is approved.
Just a comment about the small business piece. I think I would like to hear advantages or opportunities that we can offer, because I think we could probably rewrite this in a different way of bundling it. But I would like to think that what I would like to see out of it is that it clearly sends a signal that we're encouraging an opportunity where it could advantage the authority and those who would be part of the small business community, because that's the picture that I'd like to see out of this. We could find great ways to say this, but I think what we want to accomplish is that there is an opportunity.
Yeah, and let me just also add that, you know, I would be receptive to multiple awards. Are we looking at just one award? Why not a series of awards, or give us that latitude to make multiple awards?
I'd be interested in the comprehensive list of those station areas, and just stations, but areas. One of the things you had in here was that the places you had selected were based on available space, on some definition, and a minimum weekly average of 6,000 entries. But they're not necessarily all the places that meet that criteria. Right. So, you know, we might look at that as part of the effort to expand this thing. Mr. Graham, do I understand that your motion includes with it the direction that what comes back would exclude food?
Sure.
Well, I think that's a good question. Do you want to take that off the table now? Sure. If you do, then
I would.
All right. So that's in the motion. So everybody understand that. That implicit in this, or explicit now, is the direction that when it comes back, we will be putting aside the food issue for now. This hasn't been approved yet, so you all necessarily agreed to it. But that's the motion Mr. Graham's put forward.
Is that okay with everyone?
Well, that's not a question I'm asking. Is that the sentiment of the committee? I'm not hearing any dissent. So it certainly sounds to me, I'm about to ask for a vote, but it certainly sounds to me, my understanding is, this passes, you're being asked to come back next month with some, addressing some of these issues with a revised proposal that would exclude food and would address some of these specific concerns.
And could you state the concerns again, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Actually, I'm going to ask Mr. Cato to do that.
Yes, that's what I want to do.
Understand what we think we're saying to them.
I want to make sure that I have the list is correct. First of all, no food. That's very clear. Second, that we really open up the entire system and ask for input from vendors of what they can offer within the system, including very small businesses, to really open up the opportunity for small businesses, which means there could be 86 stations involved in the process. The issue of kiss and ride parking space, I have that very clear, that we work with each jurisdiction and talk to the board members before any decisions would be made. We were still have the option, anyone can bid on this. If one vendor wanted to come in and say, I can do 20 stations, that's fine, but that's not what we're really going after. We're really going to focus on a small business. Like the person I've seen selling umbrellas once before we asked to move, he might be one of the individuals who decide to do the business.
We're not limiting it.
We're not limiting it to anyone.
The one other thing I would add to that, as a question that I think you need to think more about and come back with your thoughts on, has to do with the nature of what might be. Is this somebody bringing their own kiosk, cart, something? Mm-hmm. Or is it something we have to think about differently? If they are, if we're letting others do it, do we have some parameters for it? Again, on the one hand, I don't want to make this too hard. On the other hand, I also can imagine situations where we would say, man, that would mess up the station, that wouldn't be appropriate or something. Along with the issue Mr. Graham raised of, again, how we facilitate that. I don't know what the answers are, but I just think that's something that's going to need a little more discussion.
I think a basic design of a cart, and there's been areas like in the promenade in my hometown, old hometown in Santa Monica, mm-hmm. they had standards. It had to look a certain way, be a certain size. We can look at that type of thing. But again, we won't bring back that detail, but the concept we can bring back in the proposal.
But, you know, can I just add one thing very quickly? Mr. McKay's point, I think, should be taken into account on terms of locating the stations, because I think saying that we're going to have 86 stations might be very ambitious, you know, in terms. I think limiting the number of stations for the purpose of a pilot probably makes sense. And but I think that the orientation that's evident in this list may not be the right orientation. So I don't know how others feel, but I think having a, rather than saying we're opening this up to whatever your ideas are for 86 stations, we want to identify a smaller number that we can work with. Because this vending issue, having been through the vending issue in the District of Columbia and a little bit in San Salvador, you know, I approach it with a great deal of respect and a little bit of trepidation too, because it's, you know, I have that life experience, others do too, and so maybe if we can get a bite-sized chunk, taking into account Mr. McKay's point, it might make sense.
Well, I would just say my answer to that would be that I think we ought to throw the net wide for in soliciting proposals, right. And then I think you can decide to award a limited number of them to manage the thing. But that way you let the market say, you know, we thought this was really, really good, but actually this looks like the better one because the people looking to do this really are interested in that opportunity.
Fair enough.
It's selected afterwards.
Fair enough. But we should at least mention the fact that we're not going to launch
not necessarily initially have 86 stations. Yeah, that's a good point.
Okay.
All right, questions on the motion as described? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion carries unanimously. Thank you.
Thank you.
Look forward to seeing this. This has been a productive discussion, but I think it'll be even better when we bring it to conclusion the next time. In the interest of time, I'm going to ask that we go right to item 5C. I think items 5A and B are probably going to have to be postponed for a future meeting. So,
very quickly,
Mr. Cato, who's handling 5C for us?
Sarah Pine is. Sarah Pine, I'm sorry. Sarah Wilson. We'll begin the presentation. It'll be a very short presentation.
And Donna Murray is the head of our customer research group, and I'm going to turn this over to Donna for her presentation.
Good morning. I'm here to give you an update or present the results of the Mystery Rider study for the third quarter of FY09. Go right to slide 3. Mystery Rider program is an objective tool for measuring the state of Metro services through the eyes of the customers. Mystery riding is completed on a continuous basis throughout the year, with more than 3,600 individual evaluations completed each year. The contract was awarded in August, and the first quarter was spent in the design of the inspection criteria and the sampling. The inspection criteria were designed based on primary research, secondary research, input from the RAC, evaluation of our customer complaint data, and what goes on in other properties. So we were looking for the things that were most important to our customers because this is an evaluation of the services through the eyes of the customer. If you go right on to slide number 4, the quarter 3 results summary, we look at rail route, and the rail route consists of the appendix includes a description of each of the criteria and the different elements within. The rail route consists of rail operations, physical conditions, and safety. It's actually when you're riding the train. For operations, we scored 98%. Obviously, the higher the number, the better. Physical condition was 83%, safety was 100% for an overall grade of 94%. For bus route, we can go across the same way and see that the overall grade was 88%. Sales clerks, we went to all of 4 of the Metro Rail sales offices, the Pentagon, Anacostia, Metro Center, and JGB, and that scored at 88%. Rail mezzanine scored at 87%. Rail platform scored at 83%. And bus stops, these include all the bus stops at Metro Rail stations, scored at 76%. Page 5 gives you the quarter 2 to quarter 3 result comparison. The largest change to note here is with sales clerks, which increased 25% from 63% to 88%. The answer there was they did 4 inspections in each of the 2 quarters, and at each in the first quarter, 1 sales clerk was unable to respond to the question correctly. The question was, I have all these loosed fare cards. and I'd like to get them combined onto one. The answer was the sales clerk did not have a envelope to provide to the customer in order for them to mail those fare cards into Alexandria. That's been addressed. You see the score went up to 88% in quarter three. That's where we are. Questions?
Okay, yes. First, that last point you made, what you're saying is that when they did it in the previous time, there was a specific problem that was driving that score down.
Right.
And that was addressed.
That was addressed, yes, sir.
So we saw an improvement in the service that was being provided because you discovered the problems through
this
mechanism. That's one thing since we haven't been doing these reports, we haven't had the opportunity to see that, but I think that's significant. Does any aspect of what you've been, surveying on, running this on, touch on the question of food and compliance in the stations that we discussed earlier?
What we look at is overall cleanliness, stains, spills on the mezzanines, platforms, in the trains themselves, and on the buses. You can see, if I go to rail route, and yes, I did actually write down all these scores. For physical condition on the trains, right now the score is at 65% for stains and spills. In the stations, we're at 95% for physical condition on the mezzanines, and at 90...
Okay, but this is physical conditions. This is a
right.
little different than the question that's being raised, which is, number one, a question of behavior on the part of some customers, and on the other, a question of action or inaction on the part of personnel.
Okay, I think I understand now. No, the inspectors do not look to see if there are one of the criteria is not do they see people eating or drinking on the trains or on the buses.
Or do they see Metro personnel do anything to address such conditions?
No, it's not part of the inspection criteria.
There's a lot about sales clerks. What about station managers?
Yeah. Station managers are included under the rail mezzanine customer service.
So that means? I guess I'm interested a little bit in the distinction between physical conditions, which is one thing to look at, and interactions with customers, where I actually see this as most valuable and important.
Right. On page 7 is the criteria for rail mezzanines, and customer service is included as one of those criteria. It deals with the information at the booth, the station manager present, manager in uniform. Also, they ask a question. They go up and they ask, where's the elevator to the street, or a point of interest which is close to the station? So they have scripts that they run, and they ask every station manager that they encounter a question. And they're graded on the way that they respond, whether the answer is correct, and their customer service manner.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Giancola.
Thank you. On page 56, there's a quarter three results summary, and you have an item called safety. And going down to the bus stop, 53%. I'm kind of confused. Can you define for me what are the metrics that your people are looking for safety and how they determine that 53% of the time on a bus stop is safe or unsafe? I don't quite understand how they're evaluating that.
For the bus stop, they look at functional interior lights. In other words, when you're at a bus stop at a rail station, and these are
just the bus
stops. This is just the bus stops at the rail station.
I'm more interested in the bus stop issue.
But these are only the bus stops at the Metro Rail station. So when they go to one of those major transfer stations where you have a slew of bus stops, they're looking for lighting. Is it dark? Are there lights out? Are there lights at the bus stop that are out? Are they also looking for the visibility of transit police officers? One of the things that we found...
That's it for safety?
That's it. That's for that particular criteria.
All right. Yeah, safety kind of, to me, means a lot more than that, but I hear what you're saying. Maybe we need to kind of...
And if you're looking at a regular stop, like on a street, then you have things like traffic-related safety.
Yeah, I would lean more toward, is it traffic-related safety, or is it a safe for pedestrians walking to and from it? Not so much whether the lights are out or whether or not it's, clean is another issue.
Although I would, this is part of the point I was trying to make earlier, that, it's not that we can... Metro personnel can evaluate objective things like that we can identify and grade on. The purpose of this kind of program is actually more the day-to-day operation, what personnel are doing and how they're interacting. I mean, that's really what you're mostly testing for. So
you know, I think we might be better if we understood a little better in the way this was laid out, kind of what are the things you're, you know, what is your specific objective in the way you're deploying it in a given quarter, let's say, and the second part being, then what do you do about it? I think those are the ongoing issues. Mr. Benjamin and Ms. Hutchins.
In the area of customer service on at mezzanines, the station manager, when questions were asked, did people know what the right answer was?
Yes.
So did we ask questions like, I have a smart trip card that doesn't work, how do I get it fixed?
Yes.
And what was the right answer?
You call the number, you go to Metro Center. They were giving an option, a series of options for what the answer could be.
Because one of the things I've discovered is I get enormous numbers of people who come up to me, and no matter what the problem is with a smart trip card, and often with a fare card, the only answer that they say that the station managers give is, go to Metro Center. And everybody gets all upset about that. You know, the only place I can go for this is. That highlights one of the areas where we clearly need an improvement and where a program like this can be extremely helpful. If we can identify, is this, in fact, as big a problem as it seems to be, that the wrong answer is being given fairly regularly, because it's the easy answer. If I'm a station manager, I just say, go to Metro Center. It's a place where you'll solve all your problems. So I can see some value here. In the bus route measures, I guess, that's where it would go. Were we asking issues like, was the operator talking on a cell phone?
Yes, sir.
And was the operator speeding? Was the operator going through traffic lights?
Yes, sir.
And where do we see the results of that kind of thing?
Well, you don't see those results. The actual report that goes with this is 133 pages long.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure out how, I mean, some of this stuff sounds like it could be extremely useful. Identifying the fact that those are problems can be really, really useful. But then we have to somehow see this and know how to act on it, or management has to see it and know how to act on it. So I guess I'm trying to figure out how all of this works.
The reports are done quarterly. When I get the report, I run through it and create sub-reports so that it's manageable for everybody. And then those are all sent out to the individual groups within operations so that they can act upon it. It is a powerful tool. There's no doubt about it.
If the results are then processed properly and given back to the board or given to the appropriate management people, or in some cases, maybe, you know, you have to go after an individual bus operator or station manager. Okay. And I understand you're not going to do this anymore?
It's not in the budget for FY10.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's an issue that I would like the board to discuss with the manager. I think it would be a grave mistake to discontinue this right after it started, at precisely a time when issues of service quality are being raised. Did this in part because the previous year we had a fare increase, and we heard from people that, you know, it was okay to pay a fare increase, but they really wanted quality to improve. We were looking for means to do that. I think we've already seen evidence that this can do that, even though it truly needs refinement. It already has in at least one instance we heard of. And considering the very small, tiny amount that this is of a budget, to discontinue this right when we have some of the biggest issues, bigger issues now than we had a year ago because of all the cuts we've made in the budget that affect things like service quality, I think it would be a big mistake to not go forward with this. Ms. Hutchins, you had a question.
Your issue raises a really good part in asking this question, because I read this and I thought, one of the areas that we don't look at this program is Metro Access. And it is, to me, an opportunity. And it's an opportunity in a very closed system to get a better sense of the customer satisfaction that we are trying to measure with those other numbers that we get in. For example, the customer relations line, the complaint line, or things of that nature. So I'd just be interested, is it a possibility to use it? That is, does it, as I thought about it, it could offer some complexities as to how to get there. But there are some aspects that we could look at. Most importantly, people calling in, the kind of responses they get in monitoring that in a different way, on a mystery lighter type.
We do conduct customer satisfaction research with Metro Access customers. Mm-hmm. That on a continuous basis, interviews are done every month. reports are issued quarterly. It is the Mystery Rider program. We have considered it on numerous occasions for Metro Access and have not come up with a cost-effective way to implement it yet. It's not unthought of. It's not something that we would like to do. We just haven't found a way financially to be able to address that yet.
Well, if I
go ahead, I have a suggestion.
We do a great deal of surveys on the Metro Access services, and the surveys are done for us by various social service groups, which give us wider feedback not generated by Metro staff. Of all the services we operate, that's the service that we get the greatest amount of feedback from multiple organizational sources. And so we could do anything with the Mystery Rider program is the issue of what costs and how much do you want to spend. I think we get a great deal of feedback on Metro Access, though, more than any service we operate by far.
Good point.
And they're not from just our riders, they're from groups, social service groups that give us feedback.
I'd like to hear some questions about cost and doing so. And I think it's good to get feedback from your customers in a direct way. I think it is better to see how that goes through a much more independent process of the job.
Something to continue to look at. Mr. Gray.
Yeah, I just very, very fast because I know we have to go into a board meeting. But just to reflect what Mr. Giancola said, the lowest numbers in all of these charts are safety. I don't need to say any more, but I would like to have a better analysis. I think that's what Mr. Giancola was asking. Pardon me?
More metrics need to be developed for measuring safety.
Yeah, well, you're a scientist, you know what a metric is. This is, you're an engineer. Actually.
Engineer, yeah. Thank you.
Well, so I
that's even worse, right? let's get it right.
Do metrics or analysis, but I want to know more about this. The second thing, very quickly, is that I funded through my committee, City Year, which is a great organization of young people who come from all over the region and really all over the country, who have been doing mystery riding. And I just saw their report yesterday, and Mr. Chairman, it is a very fine piece of work. And they have summaries from January, I believe. And I would like very much to ask you, if you would please, if it would be okay for us to invite them and the young riders who are so energized and so interested and have done such a competent job, and they've been working with Metro. You're nodding your head, and so that tells me.
Get regular reports from City Year. Yes.
Can we invite the young people from City Year to come and make a presentation?
I think that'd be very interesting. Yeah.
For the next meeting, I would like that before we lose those.
It's France is a meeting on the next agenda. Let's put that on a list.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yes. All right. With that, I think we need to adjourn and go to the board meeting next door. So this committee is adjourned.